My name is Sharon, and I serve the village as education coordinator. Welcome to this afternoon. It's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Laura Gifford. Laura is going to talk about reclaiming the middle ground, if there is any anymore, right? So we'll all be very interested in what she has to share with us. Laura teaches at George Fox University, just finishing up at Portland Seminary, right? And all... And it just has one more hoop to jump through?
Yeah.
Is that it? You can share that with them. So congratulations on that. We're excited to have Laura here. She'll be teaching 3 sessions. And I'm going to leave the door open because it's a little hot. If for some reason it gets noisy, someone in the back can, and I might even open that other door just for a little breeze, if it's possible. But somebody can monitor that in the back. That'd be great. Thank you very much.
Sounds good.
Sounds good. Well, welcome. As Sharon said, I do have sort of a mixed history in terms of my vocational trajectory. I have a PhD in American history from UCLA. Before that was a LUT, of which I hear there are plenty around here this week, from PLU, and I was born and raised in Portland, and that's where my family lives now. So I am almost a deacon in the ELCA, if all goes well in a couple of weeks, with the last hoop that I need to jump through in that process, and hope to be working with the Synod in the near future on education and candidacy and things of that nature, moving from the realm purely of American political history, which is my research background, toward something that engages the church and the world more explicitly. And that's a continuation in many ways of the interests that I've had as a scholar. My PhD thesis was on the 1960 presidential election, later turned that into a book, and in particular on, and I'm just remembering as Jonah comes in that I don't think that should be better. Was on the 1960 presidential election, and in particular, the precedents during that particular electoral cycle on the Republican side of the spectrum for the development of a conservative movement in the party. I've been animated by this question of how we became so politically polarized. I am sorry to say I do not have the definitive answer, and I am not expecting us to come up with the definitive solution, but we're going to be taking a look at some historical trends today, some of the developments over the course of American history that have brought us to where we are today. On Wednesday, we're going to engage a biblical example in a more interactive way to get at one example of many in the Bible of how some people with some pretty different frameworks, not just opinions but entire worldviews, were able to come to some sort of compromise and consensus. And then on Friday, we'll be taking a look at some other models for reconciliation work that are part of both the sort of political and history and also the religious reconciliation arena, and see maybe how some of these could offer some hope, some insight, some ideas moving forward. Before we get started, though, I am curious, this is something I always have done with my classes, it's something I do with church programs, just to go briefly around, and I'd love to know who you are, where you're from, because these are things that inform our conversation. And then maybe the question of the day, and my questions of the day can range from serious to downright goofy, but the question of the day maybe would be an early political memory. A campaign, something that somebody said, experiences of that nature. If my daughter was here, I'd make her share when my father asked her who was on the TV at age 2, and she said, Barack Obama, and he said, who is that? And she said, the president, and went on, which was the definitive proof that she was the daughter of a political historian. But again, my name is Laura Gifford from Portland. Early political memory, I remember being fascinated by the name Walter Mondale. I don't know why. I was in preschool, and the 1984 election stands out in my memory as the dawning of my political awareness, and for some reason I thought his name was funny. So,
our name is
name and where you're from.
Okay. Yeah. I'm Emily. I'm from Renton, Washington, which is just south of Seattle. I can remember as a child my parents would talk a lot about politics. Mm-hmm. And it sounded like they were arguing, but they agreed with it.
Which is perhaps an important lesson, too, that sometimes the contentious is not as contentious as it sounds, but sometimes it is, as we'll get into.
I'm Susan. I'm from Hastings, Minnesota, which is close to the Twin Cities. My earliest memory about politics was the election in 1960. I was for Richard Nixon because I thought he was more handsome. Which my husband later on found hilarious. I do too.
I'm Marlis and from Seattle. And probably, sadly, my first memory of politics was coming home from kindergarten and my mother hanging up clothes on the outdoor clothesline and telling me that our president had been shot.
My name's Leah. I'm from Seattle. And my first real political memory would probably be in 2004 when my fourth grade class held a mock election and Bush lost in a landslide.
My name's John. I'm from Kissimmee, Florida. And my earliest recollection was my mom that took me to see Bobby Kennedy the day before he was assassinated in Santa Barbara.
My name's Livian. I'm most recently from Racine, Wisconsin. I moved there to be with family. Otherwise, I grew up in Iowa, which takes its politics very seriously. My first political memory probably was learning that my grandfather was a Democrat and everybody in the family voted the way he voted. Which he would roll over in his grave if he knew how I voted.
I'm Floyd, West Seattle, and I can't come up with a specific event. You know, I know the age where I've had so many years.
I'm Eric from Marquette, Michigan. This wouldn't be my earliest political memory, but probably one of my most important was being at the 2008 Democratic National Convention.
My name is Monica. I live in Berkeley, but I'm from Denver. And I remember I was in England, actually, with my family on vacation. I was about seven when Clinton was elected. And the Brits at all these Libyan visa were glued to the TV. And I just didn't quite register to me that people in other countries were, like, as avidly, if not more, interested in our election. As, like, I was oblivious that all of our hosts were watching our election.
Eric, currently living in Cedral Woolley, Washington, about 70 miles as the eagle flies. And my first political memory was arguing with my mother. I was in first grade, saying that Jimmy Carter was going to be a better president than Gerald Ford because he was younger.
it's an argument, you know.
We're going this
way. Sure.
Steve in Mount Vernon, Ohio. I think my childhood was pretty oblivious to politics. But I remember my senior year in high school, I happened to be living in Dublin, Ireland for that year. This was 1980, and I still remember seeing my first mass demonstrations in Dublin with all the political prisoners, and I was like, what's going on? Why are people so angry?
Yeah.
That was eye-opening.
Noel from Ishpeming, Michigan. So pretty close to where you're at, actually. Mm-hmm. And I just remember hearing my dad make fun of Al Gore when I was younger, mm-hmm. fourth, fifth grade. I didn't really know what was going on.
Jim, I teach at Luther College in Decorah. I was born in Moline, Illinois, and my dad worked for John Deere, so I grew up overseas, actually, for the first 12 years of my life. And so my earliest memory of politics was when we lived in South Africa, and I was on my way home from school, and there was this young African boy at the gate handing out stickers. And I collected stickers, and I put them on my window in my bedroom, so I happily took the sticker, walked home, put it on my window, and my dad comes home and walks down the hallway towards his bedroom, and he sees the sticker, and he goes nuts. And he's got a razor blade out there, and he's scraping that thing off as fast as he can. And I'm like, Dad, what's wrong? What's wrong with the sticker? It's really cool. It's the Communist Party's. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh. I have no idea what the Communist Party is. But you can imagine, right? And I think you what that would have been like. So.
Absolutely.
I'm Karen from Seattle. I also struggle with memories, but I do remember my military dad was conservative, and my mom went along with that, even though I knew that her parents were good Minnesota Democrats. So it might have been Mondale, actually, or Humphrey. I think those were kind of the early ones. So, yeah. And then his comments about Martin Luther King and all. So, you know, I never thought about him, but now it all is very interesting.
Yeah.
Carl from Seattle currently, but grew up on the East Coast, D.C. suburbs. And mine is sitting on the living room floor, being glued to the TV, watching the Kennedy assassination coverage. And that was kind of like the first recognition of what a president was and what had happened and all that.
Well, that's right. I'm Sarah Grimm from Chicago, Illinois. And I was thinking of several things, but you were reminding me of, I was in Denton, Texas, on the day that John Kennedy was killed. That's 30 miles from Dallas. Mm-hmm. And happened to walk through my dorm, and when it came on, and several people, of course, from North Texas State University were in Dallas at the time. And so that was, of course, incredibly important.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm Wes. I'm here from Oakland, California, and I grew up in New York and Connecticut. And I basically just generally remember growing up during the 80s with Ronald Reagan as our president and taking it for granted that that's what a president looked and sounded like. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. My name is Jeff, and I'm from Portland, Oregon. And I think my first presidential memory, political memory, is that of the first George Bush's inauguration.
I'm Jeremy. I'm from Saratoga Springs, New York, where I'm teaching at Skidmore College. I'm also the chair of the department. I'm very interested in the idea of claiming middle ground, which seems very hard for my colleagues. Politically, I remember the election that involved John Anderson, which was in 1980. And learning about political parties and learning that there's such things as independent and thinking that sounds like a really good idea.
I'm Sharon, and I live in Moorhead, Minnesota, and my earliest memory is in the back seat of my family car coming home from family gatherings, and my mother and father going back and forth. They leaned to the left, and every other relative leaned to the right. That's all I'm going to say. Talk a lot on the way home.
I'm Rod. I'm from Hastings, Minnesota, and as a good Minnesota Democrat, I was a member of that generation of the Humphrey, Mondale, McCarthy, you know, and you know, if I think they were middle ground at that, if we look back at it now.
Jim Hastings from Minnesota. My earliest recall, and I got a crazily good memory, is that due to politics in second or first grade, doing a nuclear tuck and roll under your desk and results of politics, but the John F. Kennedy assassination right there, very vivid, and my folks never talked politics, so as a young person, I had to grow up and develop my own situation, and you know, that's it. And I'll tell you what, Minnesota is a great place.
From Rag.
Yeah. After trail around, it's
okay. My name is Gary. I'm from Belfast in Northern Ireland. Just earliest memories, I guess, was kind of just political balance beginning in the 1960s and living through that 30-year chaos.
I've followed that. I'm Colleen. I live in Puyallup, Washington, and grew up in Iowa. My earliest memory is our, I don't know, was he our senator or our congressperson? I don't know. He came, it was Harold Hughes.
Oh, yeah.
And he came to Council Bluffs, and we went down to the Ranks department store parking lot, and I shook hands with him. I felt like I was shaking hands with a rock star. I had no idea who he was.
I'm Lynn Puyallup, and I don't have a lot of memories of politics other than my dad having control of the TV, and I would go anyplace else but listen to politics.
I'm Normani. I also live in Puyallup. I grew up in Eastern Washington, a very Republican wheat farmer country, and my earliest memory is watching JFK in his inaugural speech do the ask not question, mm-hmm. which sounded so refreshing.
Mike, mm-hmm. Puyallup as well. I guess earliest memory was the Watergate debates and unfolding. Yeah. And then as far as presidential, not just sitting president, but was the inauguration of President Reagan, which I was able to go to. Mm-hmm. So see that process unfold.
Very cool. Well, thank you all for sharing, and I hope that starts to provide some a tiny window into just how diverse some of our experiences are. And we have stories ranging from the tragic assassinations and things of that nature to the funny or the argumentative. I do have to share that I wrote extensively about Richard Nixon, and you weren't alone, just for the sake of reference. There was, I have a delightful quote in my book about his visit to South Carolina. He was it Columbia or Charleston? I can't remember which city in South Carolina, and these girls were overheard exclaiming, "Oh, I see him, he's beautiful." So, and he wasn't really a bad-looking guy. It's, we kind of get this Herb Locke cartoonist impression of him. But fun things like that, and then the tragic things as well. I have a poster on my wall at home of Robert Kennedy that my dad picked up at a campaign rally in Medford, again, just on that journey south that turned out to be his final journey in 1968. So what we're doing today is taking a look at a series of events that help to explain kind of the groundwork for where we find ourselves today. Some perspective that hopefully will help establish that the political situation in which we find ourselves in 2018 is, well, distinctive, and certainly that is something that could be argued in a variety of contexts. Well, distinctive is perhaps not unprecedented in ways that we would assume in terms of the vitriol that we see, in terms of the ways that people's rights are extended or restricted. So a little bit of perspective making. Perhaps where have we made progress, where have we not, that sort of thing. And then again, on Wednesday, we'll be transitioning into a little bit more of a participatory look at Acts 15 and what that might have to say about working with groups from very different orientations. And the point behind today is that I feel strongly as a political historian that we need to understand our history, our political history, if we're to effectively engage with current events and conflicts. There's little productivity in talking if we don't recognize where those talks originated, where those ideas originated. That depth of perspective can be a useful antidote to easy answers. Of course, here at a Lutheran camp, this is not a particularly soundbite kind of a place. It's always my ongoing joke is that the Lutherans tend not to be soundbite Christians. It's a little bit more complicated than that, and I think you could say that of much of the main line, and indeed thoughtful people of faith from across the spectrum. As well, I feel like history, at least for me, can be a moderating influence simply because we recognize that we are links in a very long chain of being, and that need not necessitate compromising principles in any way, but does at least give us a bit more perspective on where we came from and where we're going. So I'm going to launch in. This is talky day in terms of my own lecturing, and When we turn to Acts on Wednesday and then to some reconciliation models on Friday, we'll be participating in a somewhat more interactive manner. That said, feel very welcome to ask questions, ask for clarification, offer insights. I am very open to that at any point along the way. We'll be covering a lot of ground. I've tried to make the connections clear. What's in my head may not match what comes out clarity-wise, so by all means, be asking those questions, because above all, it's about understanding. So getting back to the start, factions, let alone political parties, perish the thought of a political party in the early republic. The founding generation of fathers and mothers, although we don't always hear as much about them, was very much opposed to any sort of factionalism in politics. The belief was that selfish groups, factions, would advocate for their own interests at the expense of liberty or of the common good. You didn't want people organizing themselves around issues. That was not the way things should be done. You should be organizing yourselves behind candidates who would be men in this era of virtue and of goodwill, who would not make factional decisions that just benefited their own interests. They would be looking for the broader common good. Consequently, candidates didn't tend to campaign based on policies or programs. They weren't reaching out on a programmatic policy level, opposing rival interest groups. They were campaigning on their personal qualifications. And this was something that was pretty broadly shared. So it's a politics of personality, different than today's politics of personality, but in some ways we could draw parallels to the extent that the again, man at this point in time would be more important than anything in particular that he stood for. It's James Madison, key author of the Constitution, Alexander Hamilton, another very influential person, also quite trendy. George Washington, of course, looking uncomfortable over there, but very important. So men like this believed that factions were a terrible thing. They did not want people to be campaigning based upon party or programmatic policies. However, that didn't mean that they all agreed about what constituted that high-minded moral virtuosity. That inevitably led to trouble, because no matter how much you say you're above parties and factions, if you disagree on issues and programs and policies, you're going to draw together like-minded groups of people who also disagree on those programs and issues and policies, and the thing snowballs from there. It's very easy to wind up with factions when you're debating important issues, because people's opinions differ. So what wound up happening very quickly was that despite this concern with avoiding factionalism, factions inevitably formed. That said, they were still seen as a very frightening force, a very insidious force, and as a result, they tended to be seen by opposing factions as conspiracies. It led a sort of paranoid tinge to politics, again, perhaps not unfamiliar to contemporary mindsets, but this idea that if we are the people of virtue, because people representing society are supposed to be people of virtue, and those people disagree with us, well, we're virtuous, so they can't also be virtuous. They disagree with us, consequently, they're up to something. And there is something underhanded going on. This is an untoward situation. There's some sort of conspiracy that will be undermining the foundations of our new and fragile republic. And again, there was no guarantee that that new and fragile republic was going to last any length of time. So this was seen as very, very dangerous. And the rhetoric escalated accordingly in terms of this sort of politics of paranoia and conspiracy thinking. The other problem, and we'll get to this in a little bit more detail in a minute, is that if you've got only men of virtue representing you, men of virtue representing you tended to be code for people who were more economically well off, because they were independent landowners and they were not beholden to any sort of wage providers, that sort of thing. And we'll take a look at some statistics on that front in a moment. So we've got a political landscape devoid of party but riddled with factions, and everybody thinks that everybody else is out to get everybody else. We reach the election of 1800. So this is the... This is going to be the election for the fourth term of presidential office. George Washington held two, retired to Mount Vernon. John Adams, his vice president, was elected for one term. And then in 1800, John Adams and Thomas Jefferson were the two leading candidates for the presidency. On the positive side, and this is not something that we can underestimate, easy as it is to do so from a contemporary perspective, the election of 1800 was won by Thomas Jefferson. Thomas Jefferson was of an opposite faction developing into party to that of John Adams. And come inauguration day 1801, John Adams actually handed over power to Thomas Jefferson. That was pretty radical for 1801, because there was no guarantee that once one president was out of office and a new president coming in disagreed with that former president, that the former president would actually hand over the reins. That was not a foregone conclusion. It was the way things were supposed to work, yes, but that didn't necessarily mean that it was the way things were going to work. So this is a pretty big deal, this peaceful transfer of power. It was the first time that something like this had happened without any sort of bloodshed or turmoil, coup, any number of incidences of problems taking place. The transfer between George Washington and John Adams had not been problematic because the two represented a similar political faction. They were both what became known as Federalists, which meant that they were favoring a much stronger central federal government. A national bank, strong federal institutions, a government that was very much in control over that of state-level governments. But Thomas Jefferson believed very differently. He did not want to see that large and influential federal government. He did not want to see a national bank. He did not want to see state power superseded by federal power in any way. He also favored France and the French Revolution. Adams and Washington tended to be, like Alexander Hamilton, people who favored the British because we did a lot of trade with the British, and it was in our economic interests to do so. So we got a peaceful transfer of power. This is great. However, it left a pretty sour taste in the mouth of the public, because this was one nasty election. And some videos and things have made the rounds over the years, about every 4 years, coincident with our political process, of the sorts of things that were said. But just by way of a brief sampling, one Connecticut newspaper, Connecticut being a Federalist stronghold, so pro-Adams, argued that if Jefferson was elected, quoting, "Now murder, robbery, rape, adultery, and incest will openly be taught and practiced." So, some minor concerns from Connecticut. One pro-Jefferson pamphleteer wrote of John Adams that he was a, quote, repulsive pedant, and, quoting again, gross hypocrite, who, and again quoting, behaved neither like a man nor like a woman, but instead possessed a hideous hermaphroditical character. So, yeah. They get serious brownie points for the vocabulary, but not a particularly pleasant election on any number of levels. So these are important things to bear in mind. I ran across a reference. It was from a state-level New York official of Alexander Hamilton, who called Hamilton a mushroom excrescence in the 1790s. So in short, nasty political rhetoric really is nothing new, although it never is pretty when it happens. But in the midst of this incredibly tumultuous, very animosity-driven election, there is a successful transfer of power, and that's definitely nothing to sneeze at. So over the course of the antebellum period, the period before the Civil War, the United States electorate expanded considerably, but not in uniform ways, depending upon where you were and who you were. For starters, of course, anything before 1920 on a federal level would exclude the female vote. So that would be a glaring omission of 50% of the population, or 50 point whatever. But as well, there were other restrictions that were pretty widespread. In one case, those restrictions started to go down. In another, as we'll see, they actually went up over the course of the antebellum period. So this is the expansion of the U.S. electorate in terms of the number of states in the Union. It's a little fuzzy here, but and then the number that had a property requirement for voting. This is tied into that idea of virtue and of overcoming political factions, beholdenness to interests. The idea was that if you were an independent landowner, probably a farmer, perhaps an artisan in a city, but someone who controlled his own destiny, then you wouldn't be beholden to any other interests. You wouldn't be voting like your boss wanted to. You wouldn't be voting like the person on who you relied for alms was telling you to. You could be an independent actor. So in 1790, 13 states to start off with, 10 of those states had some degree of property requirement. And this could differ depending upon the state. Some were more expensive than others. Sometimes they were relatively minimal. Sometimes they were pretty significant. You'd have to be very much a person of means to vote. We can see, however, that as the number of states expand, the number with property requirements decreases. And in fact, there is never an increase beyond that initial 10. So by 1850, there are 31 states in the Union. Of those, 4 have property requirements. So not all white men are able to vote before the Civil War, but most are in most of the states, and there is a clear trend in the direction of a broader expansion of the electorate. This is all very much in keeping with the rhetoric of the common man in the 1820s and 1830s, sort of Jacksonian democracy. Yeah.
What were those 4 states that hung on?
So that is a good question, and I wish I had the explicit answer. I should have had that because it would be interesting. My guess would be New England states. They tended to be more conservative in their political orientation when it came to things like extending voting rights. It's possible they could have been states in the South as well. Almost entirely likely they would have been part of that original 13 states in the Union. New states coming in, and in particular Western states, tend to be far more expansionist in who they allowed to vote. That is a good question, though, and I should look it up and get back to you on that. The other common way to exclude people from voting was to enact racial exclusions. And this is a trend line that differs pretty strongly. So 1790, there are 13 states in the Union. 3 of those have racial exclusions on voting. And again, this would predominantly be in the South in this case, but we're going to start to see some creep in this particular category. Because as the numbers go up on the left there, numbers of states in the Union, the percentage with racial exclusions, the number with race exclusions and the percentage go up. So as my daughter was looking over my shoulder pointing out earlier today, we've got a 10-state difference here. There's only a 6-state difference by 1850. So some states that did not initially have racial exclusions instated those over the course of the first half of the 19th century. So primary reason for that would be the expansion of the electorate in terms of property qualifications falling away. Property qualifications were a pretty good way to restrict the right to vote to white property-holding males. If you extend the vote to all white males, but you don't want minorities voting, you need to start to create some additional restrictions. So that is not a downward trend line. Now, there were a couple other ways to restrict the right to vote. States, depending upon where you were, might restrict voting rights to taxpayers. That could be especially useful after the demise of property requirements as a way of restricting the right to vote, or perhaps to militia veterans, the idea being that you had to fight to support the country before you could have that right to vote. By the 1850s, states were starting to adopt literacy tests for voting. And interestingly enough, I think at least even as a historian, my tendency would be to think of literacy tests as being an artifact of the South and a way to restrict African-American voting. But Massachusetts and Connecticut were the first two states to adopt literacy tests. And this was much more about that old ideal of an educated electorate than it was of trying to restrict voting rights by race. By the 1870s, other ones would follow in restricting the right to vote based upon an enactment of a literacy test. And then over the course of the 20th century, that becomes something that is used more in the South as a way to try and exclude African-American voters who operated from a less favorable position in terms of education. Also, if a literacy test is administered by a county official, the composition of that literacy test and what's deemed passage can change depending upon who you're asking. So they could be a very useful way to screen out people who are viewed as undesirable. Now, the Civil War brings some pretty significant changes in any number of ways, but one of the most significant for voting is the passage of the 15th Amendment in 1870. And that amendment to the Constitution extends the right to vote to all men, whether they were African American or white, as long as you were a citizen, which continued to exclude Native Americans who were not citizens until the 20th century. But if you were a freedman, if you were a white man of any capacity, you could vote. And that was an important extension of the right to vote. It was also increasingly a realm that was very, very highly partisan because people were operating through systems that looked very different than the sorts of systems that we've come to understand today. This is an example. This is from the 1860 election. On the left here, of an Australian ballot, not from Australia because you're voting for Lincoln and Hamlin. This is an American ballot, but the model originated in Australia. It's after lunch and I am spacing out. This is an example of a non-Australian ballot. I apologize. Because in Australia they were innovative in terms of what they came along with in the mid-1800s. This is a non-secret ballot. Everybody's printed right there. The piece of paper might be a different size or even a different shape or color than the Democratic ticket for 1860 in your particular locality. These are the members of the Electoral College that you would have been voting for if you submitted this ticket. Basically, anybody could see what you were doing in terms of casting your vote. They could see whether you were voting for a Republican or a Democrat, a Whig, depending upon the election, any minor party. It was right out there for all to see, including your union representative, your employer, your grandfather, as somebody alluded to, your pastor, anybody who was a person of influence. And that was the way people voted up until the late 1800s, which starts to color a little bit that idea that people needed to be independent property owners, beholden to nobody, because it could be a very difficult decision to make to vote against your employer, for example. But by the late 1800s, secret or Australian ballots emerged that allowed for secrecy, privacy, and voting, where you would be doing something more familiar to our current political context. You'd be checking boxes, submitting something privately that nobody was going to see. And in that way, you could get out from under this notion that your boss or your supervisor, your union representative, could see how and who you were voting for. The first one of these Australian ballots, secret ballots, was used in Louisville in 1888. So this is pretty recent, at least from a historian's perspective. Prior to that time, in most cases before the turn of the 20th century, most people were not voting by secret ballot. The press as well was highly, highly partisan, which is something that we maybe could see as an up and down trend line. More on that to come as we creep closer to the present. But if you've ever been in Arizona and seen the Arizona Republic newspaper, the primary newspaper of the state of Arizona, this is the Arizona Republican. They kicked the last couple letters off the masthead at some point in the 20th century. And this is not uncommon. Certainly, we can continue to see that some newspapers trend one direction or the other. Sometimes names of newspapers are kind of signals of their previous partisan affiliation. But these papers, in some cases, would be subsidized by parties. So the party would actually put out the local newspaper, which meant that they controlled the content of the local newspaper, which meant that if you were reading the Arizona Republican, you were really reading the Arizona Republican, the full party line. Before the Civil War, this was incredibly common. After the Civil War, this starts to become a little bit more difficult, and by the turn of the 20th century, it's more difficult still. And the reason for that was that the costs of printing newspapers became higher, and if the cost of printing newspapers is higher, you need more advertisements. That means that the rise of objective journalism dovetails with a trend toward the need for more commercial advertising in newspapers. So perhaps an interesting coloration of this idea of journalistic integrity. Well, we could point toward lots of trends, the muckrakers of the late 19th century and early 20th century, and others who were fighting for journalistic freedom, doing investigative journalism. As well, if you want a newspaper and it's too expensive for the political party to subsidize it entirely, then you need to offer ad revenue possibilities that are going to be broader. So the Arizona Republican becomes the Arizona Republic because the Arizona Republic needs to sell ads that are going to attract both Republicans and Democrats. That's going to drive more objective journalism to appeal to this broader audience. One scholar, James Bauman, and I am going to hand out for the end of our session today kind of a extended reading list of some places to go for some more information on many of these topics, has argued that the rise of objective journalism in the 20th century has paralleled a decline in voter turnout, and draws a connection in that respect. The idea being that maybe journalists were doing their job too well, voters knew too much to the point of cynicism or disillusionment, and were failing to vote as a result. So would we rather have more partisan newspapers and everybody voting, or less partisan newspapers digging too deeply and everybody staying home in disgust? I don't know, but that is an interesting argument that I have heard made. With the demise of this highly partisan realm, though, highly partisan journalism, with the rise in secret ballot voting, the idea that the political landscape is a bit more wide open, we see the rise of bigger tent parties in the United States. And this becomes known as the New Deal Order. We'll talk about that more in a couple minutes. But as the country itself expands, our party structure expands in tandem. Increasingly, it becomes the case that people of different sections of the country have party affiliations that programmatically don't always line up very well with other parts of the country. So you might be a Democrat, for example, in the early 1900s, because you are from the South. Are you from Dixie? Because I'm from Dixie too, except I'm not, but that's... you might be from the South. The Republican Party was the party of Lincoln and the party of Reconstruction after the Civil War, or the War of Northern Aggression, if you are indeed from Dixie. And consequently, you're going to vote for the Republican Party. Regardless of other interests, you're going to vote for the Democratic Party. However, if you are in New York, maybe you are an immigrant living in a New York tenement. Boss Tweed of Tammany Hall, pictured here, is the architect of a political organization that controls New York politics, perhaps is riddled with corruption, but also makes sure that you get your basic services and perhaps even a job on the police force or in the sanitation service or in any other number of respects. And Tammany Hall is a Democratic organization. Now, if you're a southern cotton farmer, your interests are probably going to be different than if you are a northern machine politician. But it's the same party. And so the Democratic Party, and we could make the same argument for the Republican Party, becomes a bigger tent organization. If you've got more people in the same organization representing different interests, you're going to have to come to some sort of compromise within party structures, or you're never going to get anything done. And that's going to have some pretty interesting implications by mid-century. There are other things happening, too, in the United States. Perhaps the most influential is the development by the 1900s of a national American identity. So not only are you a Southern Democrat or a Northern Democrat, but you're not just an Alabaman who also happens to live in the United States, or a New Yorker who also happens to live in the United States. You're an American, first and foremost, and state-level identity really plummets below national identity due to technology, due to commercialization. The ability to have radio, for example, broadcasting programs nationally creates a common shared identity within an older framework of sectionalism. So we almost see different layers going on, a veneer of national identity over these older sectional affiliations. Everybody's hearing the same radio programs. People by the 1930s will be hearing Franklin Roosevelt coming out of their radios. They also increasingly are shopping at the same stores. This is the store window for a Great Atlantic and Pacific Tea Company, or A&P, one of the first national grocery stores. It's a little bit hard to see, but they're advertising their store brands. So again, a national organization with common products, and this is a very familiar world for us today, that you're buying not only your, you know, Del Monte or your Dole produce, but you're probably buying it in Kroger cans, even if you're buying it from grocery stores with different names on the front, Safeway products, things like that. There is this national arena now for our shared political identity, cultural identity, even as these older regional identities hold sway. And that's going to have implications for the political realm as well. The man in the middle, as most of you I'm sure will know, is Franklin Roosevelt. Who is president throughout the 1930s and well into the 1940s, the only person to run for and win four terms, the only person to run for four terms. And this is him signing a rather important piece of legislation, the Social Security Act of 1935. And he is surrounded by people primarily who are Democratic. Let me see here. Yeah, we've got mostly Democrats and a progressive. So Robert Wagner of New York, for example. This is David Lewis, who was a former coal mining executive. Frances Perkins, the first female secretary of the Department of Labor or of any cabinet-level department. Bob La Follette Jr. Is a progressive from Wisconsin, so we get a little bit of political diversity there. But things like the New Deal framework of programs result in a sea change in terms of the American political arena. The Great Depression is sufficiently traumatizing to extend throughout the American experience, or at least most of the American experience. When I first began teaching, there were still people who could interview grandparents, for example, for Great Depression memories, and I had an experience where one student came to class, other people shared the experiences of their grandparents or great aunts and uncles of struggles during the Depression, and he sat there somewhat stunned and said, I'm so fascinated to hear this. I thought it was what was in the textbooks was sort of overwrought because I talked to my grandparents, and I can't remember where they were from, somewhere, I want to say in New Jersey, something like that, and they said they really hadn't seen much of a problem. They were still fairly well off. There wasn't a significant decrease in their standard of living. So his experience, his grandparents' experience, was very much a minority experience. That did happen, and it was an interesting window into how the stories we tell and the people we talk to can impact our concepts of political problems. But in any event, the Depression and the Franklin Roosevelt administration's response to that Depression set into place a pretty strong and enduring, certainly into the 1960s, New Deal order. And a couple of historians, Steve Frazier and Gary Gerstle, have dubbed this the New Deal order. It very much took hold in the historical community as a way of identifying this. The idea being that programs like Social Security, programs during the 1930s, like the Works Progress Administration and other organizations that made work for people, programs like the Rural Electrification Association and Soil Conservation and the entire alphabet soup of the New Deal framework became part and parcel of the political landscape in very enduring ways. Some things didn't outlast World War II. We didn't need a Works Progress Administration or a Civilian Conservation Corps once the United States was at war, and World War II obviously was another paradigm shift for the United States. But things like Social Security became very institutionalized very quickly in ways that made them very difficult to impose. So we had coming along this impression of political order that was much more set, much less fluid, and that was going to be sustainable. And the language is fairly nonpartisan, even though these were party programs. More security for the American family, and you've got the mom and her daughter. There are other posters of an old man looking very congenial with his pipe, talking about how it's security for old age, and another one where there's a woman who's kind of looking down a little bit sad, and it's security for the widow, all parts of the Social Security program. By the 1950s, this was really a difficult row to hoe if you happen to be a Republican, seeking to offer an opposing vision for what the United States government structure could look like. And in fact, one tactic that was taken was to accept this New Deal order and regard it as fairly permanent, but make minor tweaks that would encourage business connections, would take differing approaches to communism, although everybody was opposing communism. That was known as modern republicanism and was the type of framework that was favored by Dwight Eisenhower's administration in the 1950s. The limits really of the mainstream political order during that period in time were defined on the one hand then by the structures of the New Deal state. This is what we have. This is very stable. We are going to keep it. And on the other by the commitment to oppose communism, also very important to do. We cannot let ourselves be overtaken by the Soviet Union or after 1949 by China. And if you fall too far to the right where you're going to be opposing New Deal programs or too far to the left where you're not going to be opposing communism, you become a political target. That is viewed by many people as a consensus politics that's not going anywhere. But by the 1950s, the United States basically has things figured out and all that remains to be hammered out are the details. This is the consensus world of the 1950s. And on the surface, it can seem very convincing. And I'm providing the historian's view. I would be curious toward the end of our conversation today if there are memories that differ or memories that illustrate. I'd definitely be very curious to hear them. But not everybody agreed that there should be a consensus, or that, in fact, the consensus represented a consensus. There were people who opposed this idea on both sides. There were some benefits to a political order of big tent parties with Southern Democrats and Northern Democrats and Western Republicans and Eastern establishment Republicans, because it's a political order that favors compromise. You have to agree within your party before you can take anything to government. And further, it's probably more likely that if you're a Southern Democrat, you're going to agree maybe with a Midwestern Republican, or if you're going to be a Northern Republican, maybe you agree with Western Democrats, far Western Democrats. There are a lot of permutations that can take place within this big tent system that allow for political compromise. That can be useful. It's also useful to have disparate factions routinely brought into conversation with each other. The Democrats across the spectrum had to some degree, get along within the party. Same for the Republicans. There were significant cons. Factions could hold disproportionate sway through tools, for example, like the seniority system. So again, using the Democratic Party as an example, because it's a useful one here, the South was a solidly Democratic part of the country. That meant that if you were a Democrat representing a Southern constituency, doing a reasonably good job in terms of what your voting public believed, you would get reelected and reelected. You'd have seniority. You wouldn't have Republican opposition for your seat. You would become the committee chair of the really important committees, like the Armed Services Committee or the taxation committees. That would mean that you would exercise a lot of political power. A Democrat coming from a political landscape where there were more contentious elections, it was more likely that a Republican might be elected to office, wouldn't hold office for periods of time that were as long. That meant that they didn't have quite as much sway. They wouldn't be the people with seniority who held committee chairs and the like. The other potential con would be that parties were relatively non-ideological. Because again, it's pretty hard to make all of these different factions agree programmatically. That could be a good thing or a bad thing, depending upon what we're going for. But it was the way things were. However, there were people who did not like this. And here we're going to be embarking on a trajectory that leads us to where we are today. There were people on the liberal side of the spectrum who argued for something called responsible party doctrine. And this was an idea that emerged out of the world of political science, the scholarly world, that parties needed to be accountable to their constituents for programs. So they needed to be able to say, we represent this program, and then show how they had done something to achieve that programmatic intent 2 years or 4 years or 6 years down the line. That was not the way things worked circa the 1950s, but it was deemed a better way of doing things by those who favored responsible party doctrine. The idea was that these older Big Ten parties weren't serving programmatic interests, and you could get more done even if you were, in that sense, cleansing, purifying your party of disparate elements. If the Republicans are going to represent Program A and somebody doesn't agree with Program A, it's more important to be able to make that programmatic progress than to have everybody in the system, that maybe they need to find a different party structure. There were people on the other side of the spectrum who agreed with that, although they were operating through very different contexts and not talking about responsible party doctrine or American Political Science Association reports. But they were saying that this consensus world, this modern republicanism of Eisenhower, was just Me Too politics. And what the country really needed was a much more forceful assertion of conservative principles, that there was a waiting body of support for these principles if only somebody would have the courage to stand up and advocate for them. And this is the conservative activism of National Review, William F. Buckley Jr.'s magazine that starts in the 1950s that is very self-assuredly pro-conservative in its orientation. So a return to maybe some more partisan journalism, although now the partisan orientation, instead of necessarily Republican or Democrat, is conservative liberal. So a slight difference in orientation. In practice, over time, that has tended to travel in a much more partisan party identification path. The candidacy of Barry Goldwater, and perhaps more importantly, the activism for the candidacy of Barry Goldwater, is very significant in combating consensus politics. So 1964 election, the Republican Party candidate is Barry Goldwater, an Arizona senator, who is a very stridently assertive conservative. For the time, we could play the counterfactual of what would Barry think in 2018, and that could be fun. But for the time, very stridently conservative, very unwilling to compromise principles, famously said that extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice. In the 1964 convention speech that he makes, accepting the nomination for the presidency, and his nomination in 64 was the culmination of years of activism. I've studied some of the earlier elements of this activism. There were many people who wanted Goldwater to be the presidential nominee in 1960 for the Republican Party. They were not successful. Richard Nixon gets the nomination. But they were strident in their activism and organized in terms of the grassroots networks that were established. And this has been a very fertile field of scholarship in recent years, looking at the sorts of networks that were created and the ways that these institutions were built. One of his many political slogans, "In your heart, you know he's right," that was the Goldwater slogan. If you were a Lyndon Johnson supporter in 1964, the phrase was, "In your guts, you know he's nuts." So just kind of depended on where you were in that particular political landscape. The forces that developed by the 1960s for responsible party doctrine, for much more stridently conservative GOP, took advantage of changes that began to happen in terms of how the electorate functioned over the course of the 1960s and into the 70s. And as these groups organized and networked and gained political power, they were able to forge new ways of choosing presidential candidates. And this becomes pretty important. As late as 1968, there were 15 state primaries. So most delegates to national conventions didn't go to the conventions pledged as a result of any sort of popular vote election or even as a result of a caucus. They tended to be people who represented the wishes of state-level party bosses, things of that nature. The political primary is a progressive era, so turn of the 20th century idea, the idea being that you give the people the chance to directly participate in nominating representative candidates, that the candidates will be more responsive to the people, but it only takes hold in certain places before the 1960s. In 1968, however, this 15-state primary election, the primaries together nominated about 40% of delegates per convention, so a minority. The 1968 Democratic National Convention was that famous convention of so much unrest in Chicago. Hubert Humphrey gained the nomination with precisely 0% of the primary vote. He was the candidate of the political professionals. It's not an endorsement or lack thereof for his personal qualities as a potential president, but it does indicate who was picking and was a harbinger of things to come for the Democratic Party, and then quickly the Republican Party followed in terms of desiring more responsiveness to the electorate. In the wake of all of that unrest in 1968 and outcry over things like that figure of 0% primary support, that doesn't mean he didn't get support in particular primaries, just that he didn't win any of them. The Democratic Party undertook a massive change in terms of how it chose political candidates. the Republican Party had its own share of activists that were advocating for similar changes because they started to see the benefits that this could have for electing more conservative candidates to represent the Republican Party. By 1980, there were 31 Democratic and 36 Republican state primaries. As of 2016, there was at least one primary in 41 states, plus was it Puerto Rico, Guam, Washington, D.C., which gets to vote in the primaries and not general election. It's nuts. So huge proliferation of parties for the primaries.
So you're saying we have nine states that don't have primaries?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's still nine that don't.
In caucus.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. So they gather.
They have some gatherings, but yeah, not full on popular vote primaries. And there may be some benefits to that. This is something that could be argued back and forth because it does provide a responsiveness. A party primary provides a responsiveness to the electorate because you have to go out and campaign, right, and gain the support of the people. The flip side of a party primary is that it privileges ideological adherence, ideological uniformity, or who can be the strongest advocate for the Democrats or the Republicans instead of for the electorate as a whole. Because you're running for a nomination that is not not the representation of the whole district, you're just catering to the wishes of Republicans and you're just catering to the wishes of Democrats or any minor party in cases where that might be a factor. That means that more conservative Republicans and more liberal Democrats are going to wind up with a considerable support because people voting in primaries tend to be the most committed voters. The most committed voters tend to be the most ideologically driven voters because they really care about these issues. And so this privileges that sort of division of right and left into ever more extreme permutations of liberalism and conservatism. And there are a variety of arguments about the different ways that this works, but it is one outcome of this type of voting. These maps are not as important for what they represent, which is good because they're tiny, but they illustrate very well just the profusion of primaries and how complicated it gets, that you can see all these little tiny districts in which up here, this is the 2016 Democratic primaries. Green is Bernie Sanders, red is Hillary Clinton, and how deep it's shaded is how overwhelming the vote was in one direction or the other. So you've got Washington, y'all were about Bernie. Oregon, pretty much, I might be Sherman County, where there are like 1,000 people, so I have 3,000 people, something like that, so I don't know about that. Midwest, we've got a little bit more diversity. You guys were a little bit more diverse in your opinions. This is the Republican vote in 2016. So the purpley-blue, that's Donald Trump. Yellow, and then shading into this darker yellowish color, that's Ted Cruz. The little green spots are Marco Rubio. That's John Kasich. And there are colors for a couple others that don't really show up. So, but we can see just how scattered it becomes and how quickly.
Why is North Dakota red?
North Dakota, yeah, that's a good question. They would not have reported back data, I think, is my... Do they do a caucus... I think maybe that they didn't have a popular vote in the same way. But then you've got Iowa shaded. Yeah, that's a good question, why North Dakota is completely...
Colorado, too.
Yeah, and then you got little pockets of color. Oh, you know what it may be? It's not reflected on this particular diagram, but I think in some of the explanatory notes on the site where I pulled these, there were ones that didn't trend strongly in any one direction, so it may represent the last vestiges of moderation in the lower 48. So, so if party primaries are a significant element, there are a few others to point toward as well. This is Richard Viguerie, I may or may not be pronouncing that right, but I'm just going to own it. And he was a pioneer of direct mail. So he is to who to blame. if you're in, your mailbox is filling with various solicitations from charities and political organizations, standing with his reel-to-reels, because this was the earlier days of computing, starting in the 60s and then very much into the 70s, he developed ways to take party mailing lists and collate them from different groups, organizations, and then create mailing lists that could be targeted very specifically to particular audiences. So if you were a woman of a certain age with children who was really upset about the lack of any sort of practice of religion in schools, boom, you could mail those people a targeted mailer that was in favor of a candidate or a program, or asking them to support a particular organization with their money or their time. This is something that becomes very powerful very quickly, as we all can see in, again, in our mailboxes on a fairly regular basis, and is picked up by other people, but he really is the pioneer. And conservatives are the first to use this sort of targeting mass mailing on a widespread basis, because he does develop these lists very early. That becomes a way to generate interest in single-issue voting. So to be able to say, these are people who adamantly oppose abortion, or on the other end of the spectrum, people who adamantly support the right to an abortion, boom, you can target fundraising appeals. You can say, this is the list of candidates who think the way you do on this issue. And that ability to target these particular interests really helps to generate support for voting on particular issues. So you're not just seeing Barry Goldwater, Republican, learning about his range of issues and then deciding whether to support him or not. You're seeing that, you know, Dudley Do-Right supports or opposes abortion, to take that example, specifically, and that is the issue that's specifically important to you, and you're making your voting decision based upon that. And he may, or she, if it's a female, Dudley Do-Right, may also support economic policy that's diametrically opposed to your interests or any other number of programs, but you're seeing the information on abortion or opposition to abortion. And that's how you're voting. So that becomes pretty powerful. Media echo chambers become a pretty significant force. There's a book that just recently came out. It's the latest iteration, and there will be a reference to it in the sheet that I passed around, called Hashtag Republic. Cass Sunstein is, I believe he was in the Obama administration at one point, but he's been both involved in political administrations as a policy wonk and also is a professor at Harvard Law School currently, and has written about the proliferation of media echo chambers fairly powerfully. This is a latter edition of something that started out as, I believe it was just Republic, and then Republic 2.0, and now it's Hashtag Republic, and so then he's going to have to come up with the next way that, that people organize their digital landscapes for his next volume, evolving all the time. But CNN comes along in 1980, less ideological, but all news. Fox News and MSNBC come along in 1996, although MSNBC does not start out as ideologically oriented as it evolves. Facebook comes along in 2004. Twitter comes along in 2006. It is amazing to think that these things did not exist that recently and how different our lives were. But all of this leads to what Sunstein refers to, drawing upon earlier work by an MIT technology specialist by the name of Nicholas Negroponte, of the emergence of the daily me. And so in 1995, Negroponte, this tech specialist, postulates that eventually it's going to become the case that you're going to be able to gain access to the daily me as your newspaper source, your news source, and it's going to be only things you're interested in from the viewpoint that you want to hear them and in the way that you want to hear them. Here we've got the login. I'm not even sure if this is the most recent one because I had to do Twitter for a class live tweet session, and I've barely looked at it since. But welcome to Twitter. Get real-time updates about what matters to you. So we have the Daily Meet. In other words, this is very specific to our needs. And on the shoulders of all that we've covered today with regard to the political evolution and the ebbs and flows of partisanship in the American political landscape, what does it mean to have a situation where we can access the Daily Me in a way that allows us to filter out voices that differ from us? I would argue that's a next step and one that we find ourselves operating in very explicitly in the contemporary landscape. I know that there are people who have no idea how one side can vote the way it does, and a corresponding group of people who have exactly the opposite view, and part of it is this personalization of the media landscape that allows us to filter out anything that incurs our disagreement. That makes the public landscape for conversation very, very difficult. If we're not listening to the same news sources or engaging with each other in any sort of meaningful way regarding the issues. Sunstein argues for what he calls an architecture of serendipity, that tech companies like Facebook or YouTube or Twitter should engineer into their software tools that pop up things that that don't meet your usual aggregation of whatever fancy logarithms they use to determine what you see on a daily basis, so that it would intentionally insert not just crazy Aunt Phyllis's whatever post that you see occasionally, whether that's to the right or the left, but that would be reputable news sources that would differ from what you typically take a look at, just as a way of inserting something different into your ideas on a daily basis. And so it's an interesting concept. But I want to leave us with a little bit of food for thought. Some ideas to keep in mind as we think over the next couple of days. There's a deer out there. I thought it was a dog. It's a deer. Moving forward, and that we can engage in more extensive detail, maybe on Wednesday and Friday, or for those who are elsewhere on those days, to be continuing to think about. First thought, Cass Sunstein's two prerequisites in hashtag Republic to a well-functioning system of free expression are as follows. And so this is getting into the media and what we read and what we see and how we see it, but with regard to the political landscape and how we experience it. First, the people should be exposed to materials they would not have chosen in advance. That can function in a number of ways, whether that is I'm just a soccer fan and occasionally I read something about tennis, or I'm just a Republican and occasionally I read something that is a Democratic analysis. And even though the sports thing seems a little bit crazy or very basic in its context, that there can be value simply in having those sorts of shared experiences with other people. If we understand other people's interests, we're more likely to engage productively with them. And then secondly, that many or most citizens should have a wide range of common experiences. So there have been reports in the news, right, about how our current president watches Fox News very religiously to get an idea of how he's being interpreted by the conservative political audience, or the more right-leaning political audience. Lyndon Johnson in 1968 had three television sets in the Oval Office, certainly operated from his own political orientation and partisan perspective, but they were ABC, CBS, and NBC, because that's what there was. And Sunstein argues that there's something important about having common experiences with other citizens, whether that's watching the same sporting event or watching the same news presentation or participating in any other sort of civic life. The conversations that we have over the course of the week here with people from different places and different orientations qualify as well. And in particular, if we can bring them back to our communities. Secondly, second bit of food for thought, and this is very different source, but just a crazy statistic that I thought was fascinating and worth some reflection. This comes from Alan Hilton's book, I'm talking about this a little bit more later in the week, A House United. It was one of the recommended readings for this week. Very thought-provoking book. When asked in 1960 whether they would be displeased if their son or daughter married someone from the opposite political party, 4.5% of respondents answered yes. By 2010, 43% answered yes. And I can only imagine that that's gone up in the last 8 years. So pretty stark numbers, worth some reflection. What would you have that I was looking these over before we came down. Again, my 12-year-old said, well, what would you do if you're married a guy? Well, we would deal with that when it came. But, I would like to think that I could get beyond that. That would be... and then finally, again, something very different from the previous two, but an interesting idea to engage. When I worked at George Fox, I moved on from there a couple of years ago, but the department was a shared department of history, politics, and international studies. So, again, some common experiences. Ron Mock was a colleague, political scientist. He was a legal scholar who was very interested in reconciliation work and peace work. He was a very committed Quaker and had written fairly extensively on peacemaking. He wrote a document that I have not been able to find in any sort of public arena, but it was for a cumulative senior seminar that all students at George Fox took as part of their senior year capstone. In which we intentionally mixed them up and then made them do projects, groups of students from different majors. It drove them batty, but it was a good experience. They had to read this document in which he talked about solving problems and seeking answers to complex solutions, complex issues. And he started from the predicate, the position that God loves us. And if God loves us, God wants our needs to be met, or desires that our needs to be met, and will provide conditions whereby the needs of everyone might be met, and that can apply to any sort of complex situation. That there is a solution that exists that is a peaceful, justice-oriented solution whereby the needs of everyone might be met. Now, the important word here might be needs, as opposed to wants, desires, perceived needs that maybe aren't really needs. The execution of the idea can be pretty complicated, but it's a very thought-provoking idea. The concept that there are solutions that exist whereby the needs of everyone might be met, because a God who loves us would not provide for the absence of that. That possibility, even as we are in a position of trying to exercise what that means in practice. So we have a handy-dandy clock, and I can see we're almost at time. I'm going to just start that going, and the recommended reading, or the if you're interested reading, obviously there is not homework. List if any of the topics today or later in the week particularly pique your interest. But we've got a few minutes left. Comments, questions, thoughts, opinions? Yeah.
Well, it seems like in today's world that
media drives the way that life is instead of politics sometimes. And it's just like, how come that you can get three media sources can all watch a chicken cross the road, but they have all different slants on it? And that drives all the different people's emotions. It gets away from the facts and stuff. So when did that come into existence?
It's a good observation and a good question, because it does seem, and I was even noticing in my own head as I transitioned to the last couple slides, that it's a transition in a lot of ways from these are political parties to this is how the media influences. I would argue, and I welcome other opinions, that the development of, or redevelopment, if we're looking at what happened with party newspapers in the 1800s, of specifically ideologically oriented news sources has had a pretty significant role to play there. Because if we've got a situation where people are not even necessarily striving to articulate a nonpartisan or objective position, it becomes much easier to just look at those particular positions, and they've been rewarded for that. In interesting ways, I think that the technological realm in which we operate, where we can fragment ourselves technologically so much more easily, plays a role too, because it wasn't an economically feasible practice in the same way in the early 20th century. Newspapers were expensive and they needed to appeal to mass audiences. Now we're in an era where we can use cable news or the internet and its technologies to efficiently and effectively and in a cost-effective way target particular constituencies. I think that that probably plays as much of a role as anything. But yeah.
Along with that idea, I was in China in 1988 when Tiananmen happened. I had a role with the U.S. government there. But I came back and was sent home to the U.S. because of the unsafe situations over there. And I was asked by a reporter to give some comments. And I said, why is it so different from CNN watching it than what I saw and heard from talking to people in China before I left? Mm-hmm. And he says, we need to create things that draw people's interest. Mm-hmm. We need to have viewership. It's not necessarily the truth.
Mm-hmm. Right? Consumerism.
Yeah, yeah. It's that emphasis on selling that idea, which can be an uncomfortable fit with deeper reflection. Again, getting back to my kind of flip but nonetheless sincere comment about a place like this or perhaps a mainline religious denomination not being a soundbite sort of organization, political deliberation on a deeper level often is not the easy soundbite, and that's a difficult thing to sell in the contemporary media landscape, that you need a length of time to discuss an issue. Yeah.
Well, I wonder, how many people own multiple media sources of opposing conservative viewpoints? So that somebody owns both a conservative radio station and a liberal mm-hmm. radio station because they want to have consumers on both ends.
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting question. I wouldn't know the statistics on that, but it's a fascinating proposition that you could have, people who the commercial considerations outweigh the sort of ideological considerations. You can theoretically sustain a pretty significant share of the market if you've got both the liberal and the conservative talk radio in town.
Eating out your hand.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm interested in your observations about how the very structure of our electoral system, mm-hmm. in particular primaries, mm-hmm. has shaped the polarized mm-hmm. atmosphere. And I'm wondering if you, and this may anticipate what you're going to talk about in future days, but is there any hope that we may actually be able to forge a new way of electing mm-hmm. officials?
Yeah.
I know some states have been experimenting with I can't remember what it's called, but it says something other than a winner-take-all
rank choice.
Yeah.
Is that something, are options like that feasible on the national level?
Yeah. There certainly are possibilities that exist. Yeah, ranked primaries would be one opportunity to get around some of this polarization that primaries have caused. Open primaries, which have their share of supporters and detractors, can be another one. the benefit to an open primary, which would be everybody votes for the slate of candidates, Republican and Democratic alike, is that you can wind up with two Democrats or two Republicans being the two top vote winners. So then in the general election, that eliminates one party from contention, but the opposite end of that argument would be that people are appealing to a broad electorate early on. That can be one tactic. Curiously enough, in states where the parties are not as, where both parties aren't equally strong, or where one party is overwhelmingly dominant, would be a better way of putting it. Sometimes because the vast majority of the electorate is voting Republican or Democratic, you can start to have a system that is a little bit less ideological in the primary, because the general election will be less contentious, and there's a recognition of that. That doesn't always work out, but it can happen. There are very powerful and entrenched interests that favor the current system, but there have been powerful and entrenched interests that have favored previous iterations. And so I wouldn't say that it's outside the realm of possibility. But it would take pretty extensive citizen activism. And generational change, too, and it's something that I wonder about. I certainly noticed, in terms of the conversations I would have with students, a certain generational readiness in many ways, and whether this will play out in reality or not is up for debate, but a readiness to get beyond some of what they have grown up seeing. As a generation of people born in the 80s and 90s and operating very much in that framework, and seeing the problems without having the investment that perhaps previous generations had in that current way of doing things, that may have some benefits. And there's a certain generational trend toward less partisan orientation, certainly a rise in independent affiliation, but also people just wanting something different, and that can have interesting permutations, like the people up the street from our house who are huge Bernie supporters and then went for Gary Johnson. For the Libertarian candidates in the general election, we could tell all this because they really like political signs and bumper stickers. So I was just kind of watching this evolution, and these were all legitimate positions, but it was obvious that one of the things that was animating them, just from the combination of the political signs, was that it was something different, anything different. And to the extent that that can be capitalized on, there's a possibility too, I'd say. So I recognize we're at time, and I want to respect your time and the time of session leaders to come. So thank you for your attention. Again, this is the talkie day, so we're going to be shifting gears. I guess it's Wednesday evening is the second session of this. And taking a look a little bit more reflectively at what a very different source can tell us about what it might mean to challenge some of these trends, or at least bring people together in any sort of meaningful conversation. All right, I welcome you all.